Hey everybody, welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host Ryan Krause, taking you back in time to the 1990s for a fascinating look inside a shocking and gruesome crime that resulted in the stabbing deaths of two young boys, aged 5 and 6. In the early morning hours of June 6, 1996, 911 dispatchers received a frantic call from a 26-year-old mother in Rowlett, Texas, named Darlie Routier, who claimed her sons were bleeding to death as the result of an attack by an unknown intruder who also injured her before escaping into the night. When police arrived at the home in the upscale suburban community outside Dallas, they discovered what amounted to nothing less than an absolute bloodbath. 6-year-old Devin is already dead, lying on his back on the carpet in the living room, while 5-year-old Damon is clinging to life. It's truly terrifying. So, I'm going to play the 911 call for you here in a moment, but first I want to set the table for the events to come. In terms of the disparity between what the police find at the Routier house as opposed to the claims Darlie makes to them. Earlier in the evening, the entire family gathered in the living room to watch a movie and eat popcorn. At some point, their 7-month-old son Drake was taken upstairs to sleep, and the rest of the family remained downstairs until approximately 11 p.m. This is when Darlie's husband Darren decides to go upstairs to bed, where he and the baby remain after that time. Darlie, 5-year-old Damon, and 6-year-old Devin stay downstairs and sleep well into the night. But that's when something goes wrong. Around 2:30 a.m., Darren wakes to the sound of glass breaking downstairs, and suddenly his wife is shouting his name. Darren rushes to the living room to encounter nothing short of his worst nightmare. Both Damon and Devin have been viciously stabbed on the floor, and it appears Devin might already be dead. A confused Darren repeatedly asks Darlie what the hell happened before hurrying to Devin's side to give him CPR. According to the father, when he blew into Devin's mouth, air came out of the boy's chest. Meanwhile, Damon is gasping for air and trying desperately to cling to life. Darlie tells Darren that a man entered and exited through the garage and that she must have fought with him but can't remember because she just woke up on the couch bleeding after the attack when Damon crawled to her and began pleading for help. Darren finds a screen cut out on one of the garage windows, but there's no sign of anybody else having been there. Aside from the obvious victims and the appearance of a struggle in the room by way of furniture being knocked over. And here's where it starts to get a little controversial. While the two boys are brutally stabbed to death, Darlie sustains a wound to one forearm and a long slash on her throat that runs down toward her chest. She claims to not remember the attack and somehow ended up lying on her back on the couch in her nightshirt, bleeding from her wounds as the intruder fled. She regains consciousness moments later when Damon seeks her help. Of course, the slash to her throat came within 2 millimeters of slicing her carotid artery, meaning she possibly could have bled to death from the injury, despite the police arriving only 3 minutes later. So, we'll talk more about Darlie's injuries after the 911 call, but for now she's picking up the phone to dial. She's frantic and highly emotional. But is it real? Judge for yourself.
911, what is your emergency?
Ma'am?
What's going on, ma'am?
Oh my God!
Okay, and we're back. So, that's obviously a bit of a frantic exchange, one made back in 1996 when the sound quality was perhaps a little less than what we might expect today. With that in mind, we're going to examine some of the transcript for this 911 call, which I believe is incredibly revealing. Now, I make assessments of emergency calls in a slightly different manner than most would, meaning that I examine the disparity between what the caller claims to want and what that person truly asks for, all of which is filtered through a system of linguistic values predicated on use of that result as a means to determine the presence of honesty or lies. Basically, what I'm saying is people will always tell you what they desire. But, as in any situation in life, you have to read between the lines. For instance, if a man is hell-bent on having sex with his date one night, it's possible he might not ever mention it. He might just try to keep refilling her glass of wine. If a child wants a cookie right before bed, and his mother said no yesterday, there's a decent chance he might sneak into the kitchen, stand on a chair, and steal the cookie from the jar without so much as mentioning to his mom that he wants a snack. Desire is hidden more than anything else in the world because it's often forbidden. You can't go on that date and just force yourself on that woman for sex, and you can't go up in the cabinet for cookies when mom already told you no. It's the reason we live in a world of lies. We can't tell anybody what we desire. At least, not explicitly. For those occasions, we have subtext and prioritization. So, if we look at the start of the call, here's what we find. The operator asks Darlie's emergency, and these are the first words she speaks. Quote, "Somebody came here." And then the next part of it is, quote, "They broke in." And from there, she doesn't say anything until prompted by the operator, who says, "Ma'am?" And the response from Darlie is, "They just stabbed me and my children." When the operator tries to inquire further, starting the question with the word "what," Darlie doesn't elaborate. She only says, quote, "They just stabbed me and my children." The response from 911 is, "Who?" Darlie doesn't answer, so "who did?" follows. And Darlie's response to who committed the crime is, quote, "My little boy is dying." So let's circle back to the start of this one. The first thing Darlie wants us to know, even before the fact that somebody broke in, above and beyond everything else to the point it's her primary communication in the call, is that somebody came to the home. Notice we don't get the words, quote, "My little boy is dying," until the end of the initial part of the exchange, when it's absolutely the most important part, from a criminal perspective, in addition to medically, emotionally, and otherwise. This is the moment that the 911 dispatcher takes action, at the moment Darlie says her little boy is dying. And like so many suspicious parents before her, guess what she's going to do once the operator kicks into gear to help? Interfere. Now, you can't preemptively hang up the phone or lock the door to prevent the cops from coming in, so the ways in which one can be legally uncooperative are limited. This is why so many perpetrators of such crimes rely on emotion. They can get away with it. If you're a frantic mother whose kids were just stabbed, there's no law that says you need to be calm and collected when experiencing such a horror. So, they hide in the place where criticism of their actions will be least acceptable. And that's in the throes of grief and loss. Overwhelmingly, when I analyze 911 calls for the sake of legitimacy, what I find is creation of aesthetic emotion, which I've discussed before, wherein a person experiences the emotional fallout from a traumatic event at the moment the event ends, in the same way you experience when watching a movie. There's not enough screen time to watch the protagonist go through a montage of misery every day for weeks after the event, so the emotional suffering of grief is rearranged so that it occurs in place of shock, thereby expediting the end result. But that's the problem. That's how we write fiction, and also how we film movies, because they're manipulations of the truth we create to foster understanding. A film can be full of lies from beginning to end, and still be an amazing accomplishment. In fact, if you make a film full of lies in which the subtext tells the truth beneath the surface, you might find yourself collecting some trophies during awards season. We have an enormous film industry in America dedicated to replicating the nuances of actual situations, one that's larger than any in the world. Yet despite the fact money sometimes grows on trees in that industry, and abundant financial resources are regularly engaged to create top-notch content, one very stark reality remains. Most of the movies Hollywood makes are shit. In fact, most movies ever made are garbage. It's a small percentage that shine. And at the core of that idea is the obvious lesson that the truth is difficult to replicate. In fact, it's nearly impossible. That's why people remember Shakespeare and not your uncle with a great sense of humor who was ranked number 3 in his shuffleboard league at the local bar before dropping dead from a heart attack. So, the way we separate the amateurs from the pros in this endeavor is nuance. Each stroke of the paintbrush, each strum of the pick against the guitar string, and every note that comes from the soul of a singer are all subjected to a cumulative observation of quality by way of the success of one thing. Nuance equating to truth. Nuance is the primary element that gets us closer to the truth within the confines of replication. Don't believe me? Compare the first Godzilla to the most recent Jurassic Park. The difference is astonishing, but therein lies the problem. Those who resort to replication, for which they have no expertise, will fail. And in the case of Darlie Routier, we have a woman who's about to try to overcome this principle and do so in the high-stakes game of murder, which is a huge mistake. Because murder isn't art. It isn't subjected to feelings. It's dealt with by science. And that's where these people fall into the abyss of ignorance, in that gap between what they expect to achieve by offering an ambitious artistic rendering and what really happens as a result of the receiving parties utilizing science. You can do this if you've done it 1,000 times over already, and experience has taught you how to overcome this adversity. For instance, Hollywood now uses branding to pull the wool over our eyes, re-releasing old favorites in the form of shitty remakes and sequels that will never be applauded for quality, but will bring in at least 60% of the gross on the original, and at a much lower budget. You can do that when there's only money at stake. The theater-goer can walk out unhappy and feeling cheated and disappointed, and you don't suffer any criminal consequence. But a murder is like a car engine. It has many moving parts, too many to count. If you've never been under the hood, but try anyway, it's going to look desperate, and you're probably going to fail. For one reason, you fucked up the nuances. So right off the bat, Darlie tells us that A, somebody came to the home, B, that person broke in, and C, somebody stabbed her, before mentioning the boys. Now, according to Darlie, one of the boys, Devin, is dead, and Damon is dying. This is a dire situation that requires immediate disclosure of the injuries at hand, yet they're saved as the last of the primary details, rather than the first. Again, the dispatcher takes immediate action to deploy an ambulance when learning of this, and when she does, Darlie begins to interrupt her and indulge my favorite guilty technique, begging repeatedly for the ambulance that is obviously already coming. Even once the police have arrived outside her home, she ignores them, continues to ask for the ambulance, and wonders aloud what's taking so long, when truly they get there really fast. The police arrive in 3 minutes. The ambulance follows. Of course, it isn't fast enough to save the boys, but it seems apparent to me they were going to die from the wounds regardless. The injuries were quite severe. Yet, the problem here already is that Darlie is no longer concerned about the intruder who supposedly just killed both of her young sons with a kitchen knife and slashed her throat. If he had the audacity to commit such a horrific act in the absence of an available motive, we should consider him very dangerous. Yet, she's not telling 911, or even her husband, that this guy could still be on the property. So let's take a step back and view the situation from afar. I think it bears observing. If you're an intruder, this situation suggests one of two scenarios, either a botched robbery or burglary, or the work of a deranged killer, absent of motive. Neither fits very well, but let's look at the burglary scenario. Most people looking to burglarize a home will look in the windows if they're outside the place at night and intending to enter. One reason might be to establish what items of value are inside, but an even better reason is to learn if anybody is around to cause a potential problem. If you come upon a nice suburban home like the Routiers had and think there might be valuables inside, you're bound to take a look. Even if you don't, what we're supposed to believe happens next is an intruder cuts a window screen in the garage, enters the house, and, stumbling upon the two kids and their sleeping mother, decides the best course of action is to murder the kids, injure the mother, and flee the scene with her left alive as a witness. Conversely, if there was no burglary planned, and murdering the kids was the objective, there's no motive, and somebody who's just committed an act that will later prove worthy of the death penalty for the perpetrator leaves a witness alive. If you're the killer, there's no reason to believe Darlie is dead after the throat slash and cut to the arm, so why would you flee the home without inflicting a fatal wound? She claims to have woken up on the couch, lying on her back after the attack. The intruder could have finished her off without incident, and we can't make the argument that she fought him off and he fled prior to her lying down, because there's no physical evidence she fought with another person. A vacuum is overturned, and a table. Glass is broken. There's blood everywhere. Darlie is badly injured. But she doesn't appear to have fought off an attack of any kind, especially a stabbing. There's not a single indication that Darlie was subjected to a vicious stabbing assault consistent with the manner her sons endured. To put it bluntly, she got off easy. Now, let's reverse this train and look at Darlie's potential motive. But first, let's observe circumstance. Darren and Drake are asleep upstairs, which means the baby and husband won't hear the boys' agonizing cries in the 3,600-square-foot home. It also means that Darren won't be around to fight off the intruder, identify him, or even lend any credibility to his existence, making Darlie only one of five people in the home who can do so. Yet, after the incident, she claims she suffered what equates to amnesia, and remembers nothing about the killer or what transpired between the two of them, which is the most convenient way to go when it didn't actually happen. You let the cops fill in the blanks. Unfortunately for Darlie, they did, and what they came to believe is she had the motive, opportunity, and means to commit the crime. Darlie had a nice lifestyle for a 26-year-old, but her husband's computer business had recently begun to struggle, leaving the couple arguing over finances in the aftermath of the birth of their third son, Drake. On top of that, Darlie was supposedly suffering from severe postpartum depression in relation to her most recent pregnancy, which isn't too surprising considering it was her third. Nature generally dictates a behavioral shift when going from groups of two to three, so the siblings essentially went from being a pair to being a pack, and Darlie got overwhelmed. Their needs increased, financially and in terms of attention, and she wanted out. But it is important to note that, in contrast to other mothers who have killed their children, Darlie doesn't have an extensive psychiatric past leading up to the event. For all intents and purposes, it seems to have coincided with the birth of her third son, Drake. Anyhow, no items of value were taken from the home. No intruder was ever detected. The murder weapon came from inside the home, and Darlie voluntarily touched it, even to the extent she picked it up, after it was apparent to her it had been used to commit the crime. She suggests this truth to the 911 dispatcher, and then goes on to lament that she shouldn't have done that because maybe the cops could have used the fingerprints the intruder left on the knife before she tainted them. But nobody else's prints are on it. not even unusable prints, just Darley's. Darley says on the call that the man stabbed her. She woke up, and then, in her exact words, quote, "I was fighting," end quote. She doesn't specifically say she fought with the intruder, because there wasn't one. And we're supposed to believe the boys would be stabbed to death while lying on the floor with deep wounds to the chest and back suffered by a knife with a downward-pointing blade, while the intruder found Darley asleep in the same position and merely slashed her twice? But let's give this young lady the benefit of the doubt. Let's say an intruder would do something like that. He comes in, kills the kids, slashes her, and then she wakes up to fight him in the living room, which is already a bloodbath, but now she's bleeding badly from her neck wound. Yet, there's the next problem with her story. The vacuum cleaner is tipped over, but all the blood is beneath it on the carpet. The same goes for the broken glass on the floor, which is the noise that supposedly caused Darren to wake up on the second floor. The blood is under the glass. It doesn't take a genius to figure out there's a serious problem here. Darley says she got stabbed, and then she woke up to fight, but there's no blood on top of anything involved in this bogus fight. So let's take a look at her injuries. Again, Darley has a deep slash running from the lower area of the right side of her neck down toward the center of her chest. At first glance, it appears a slash of this nature would be harmful by causing a wound that's prone to significant blood loss, yet it doesn't seem to be what you'd consider fatal. Many contend that the fact the wound comes within 2 millimeters of the carotid artery is an indication that Darley was attacked, as nobody would ever think to take such a risk. But I ask you to consider the result. If Darley had endured any lesser injury than what was inflicted upon her, almost nobody would believe in her innocence. Conversely, if Darley had suffered a wound any worse than the one she reported, she'd have died. What this says is that her calculation is accurate. She took a big enough risk to make people doubt her guilt, but not one big enough to kill her in the process. So she succeeds in the overarching theme of her deception, but nuance is going to put her in prison because, to put it bluntly, Darley Routier isn't very bright. She doesn't know shit about forensics, crime scene investigation, or anything similar. Now, let's jump back to that statement from Darley again. She says, quote, "I was fighting," end quote. And you might be thinking that the lack of identification of a perpetrator in this statement doesn't mean there wasn't one. But consider this. If Darley says, quote, "I was fighting him," instead of saying, quote, "I was fighting," it's game over. She'd have been executed by now. So that was actually a very good move on her part, because explicitly telling the dispatcher she fought with the man leaves an immediate impression that physical evidence of this person's existence, whether in the form of fingerprints, DNA, or clothing fibers, will be readily available in the aftermath. But because there won't be any, and never has been since the time of that call, Darley will initially say that she was, quote, "fighting," and later claim to have blacked out. And here's where Darley makes it even worse on herself in the 911 call. She messes up when crafting one of the nuances of the story, and has to backpedal. She tells the operator for a second time that the perpetrator, identified with the masculine pronoun he, ran out through the garage. But immediately she realizes her mistake, which is that if she remembers him running out through the garage, then that means she was also coherent during the alleged fight that preceded it. Yet, since there's not actually an intruder, and there won't be any physical evidence of one on her or anywhere else in the room, she knows she can't remember the attack. If she does, she'll have to commit to nuances that align with the forensics conducted at the scene, in addition to identifying the killer. All of that is a mountain too tall to climb for Darley, so in mid-sentence, she changes her assessment of the intruder from he to they, negating any and all identifying factors before ending the sentence with the words, quote, "I was sleeping." So we went from Darlie witnessing the intruder escape through the garage to her learning of this escape upon regaining consciousness and finding the knife. In the same sentence, and utilized as a break in the middle between the shifting gears, is the sound, Darlie is thinking, but dumbfounded. It's the only time in the call that she stops the narrative to make that noise. In fact, it's the only time she makes that sound. Clearly she caught herself in a mistake related to nuance, with the situation being she can't actually see the man run out, because then she'll be able to identify him, at least to a certain extent. She needs to achieve ignorance to avoid being able to identify the killer, but fails due to that same principle. Ignorance. And the reason is, you can't construct a story about what happened while simultaneously claiming you weren't conscious to remember any of it. And here's where she runs into a brick wall yet again. She said the killer went out through the garage, but then says she was asleep when it happened and found the knife lying out there. So, according to the terms of her own version of events, she doesn't actually know that the intruder is gone. She simply knows that he left the bloody knife in the garage, and the window screen was cut in a manner that suggested it was used as a point of entry. She has no idea where the perpetrator truly is. But what does she do next? Right after two of her young children have been murdered? She yells for her husband to come downstairs. And what does he do? Like he tore a page right out of the Kate McCann handbook? He runs downstairs, leaving 7-month-old Drake upstairs by himself, at a time when nobody knows where the killer is or why he attacked the young boys. I'd say it's a decent assumption your other son is also in danger. But Darlie doesn't even ask him. She just calls her husband downstairs. There's no concern for the baby. And why? Because there's no danger. Likewise, when the cops come to the door, she doesn't even seem to welcome their assistance and doesn't answer the door until specifically being instructed to do so by the 911 dispatcher. Now, I don't know about you, but if a murderer just went apeshit in my living room with a kitchen knife, killing my children and slashing my throat, I'm answering that door. In fact, I'm running to it because I'm absolutely fucking terrified. In all honesty, this is some scary shit. That is, unless you know there's nothing to worry about. Notice that Darlie is extremely emotional, even to the point of being hysterical at times, yet she never gives any indication whatsoever that she is, or was, afraid. The facts show that she didn't even think it was pertinent to let the cops in the home. All she wants to know about is the ambulance. And this is where psychopaths and sociopaths make their living, where they spread the butter onto the bread and offer it to you with a grin because they know you're eating a shit sandwich. Time and again, in all types of murder cases, I see the public crumble to dust under the false pressure of purely manufactured aesthetic emotion that bears no resemblance to reality. People look at the faces and listen to the words and try to see through the smokescreen to determine legitimacy and dishonesty. But those elements are not found in the vibrations released from a person's mouth, or even in our intuitive reaction to what we hear. A person's intent should be dictated by the nature of action, or even inaction, but never emotional release. So Darlie Routier can cry her eyes out from now until the end of time, and beg wildly for an ambulance to come faster so it can save her children. But what she can't do is the following. Darlie can't prove anybody else touched the murder weapon. She can't prove an intruder entered the house. She can't offer any explanation for why her wounds differ from those of her children, specifically why she was slashed instead of stabbed. A larger target doesn't require a lesser effort. It requires a bigger one. She can't explain why she showed no concern for Drake being upstairs alone when yelling for Darren to come downstairs. How can this be when the person specifically entered the house to kill the children? As a mother, you'd certainly scream for your husband, but your surviving child would be at the forefront of your mind. You don't know if he's okay. You don't know if the killer's upstairs. So while Darlie is reportedly devastated by these events and could barely say anything beyond, quote, my babies are dying? How is it she can't consider her other baby's life? And what's really revealing is that Darren doesn't do these things either. He comes downstairs, learns of what happened, and leaves Drake upstairs unattended. Yet Darlie says she was, quote, asleep when the intruder left. So how does she know he left? He could be upstairs waiting for her to call for Darren, so he can murder Drake when Darren rushes to help. But here's the problem with all of this. The public excuses almost anything tied to emotion. Oh, you were distressed? Well, then you're free to abandon logic in its entirety. You have a get-out-of-jail-free card. And I ask myself, why the hell do we concede such nonsense? People who have been in dire circumstances predicated upon life and death know one thing is true. You don't abandon logic during these times. In fact, your logic actually expands to include possibilities that wouldn't otherwise be available. For instance, we all know the stories about something extremely heavy like a car rolling over a child, and the mother is so freaked out that her adrenaline allows her to actually garner the strength to lift it. It's truly amazing, and a real thing. And that's because we're designed to accommodate extraordinary circumstances. But Darlie wants nothing to do with acknowledging this reality in any way, when the truth is that the fucking cops are at the door because you just reported multiple homicides, and it doesn't seem reasonable to ask EMTs to tend to your children if they're going to get butchered in the process. So again, Darlie has not expressed concern for the safety of anybody in this matter, from herself to Darren to Drake to the police to the EMTs. She simply does not care about anything except the ambulance. And why? Because that's the extent of the neglect she can get away with. Guilty people use hysterics to fuel inaction, whether it's not answering questions or not cooperating physically at the crime scene. At this time, Damon is clinging to life, about to stop breathing, and she's doing everything she can, within reason, to stall the process, because even just a few seconds could be the difference between life and death. And this shit is so predictable. Notice that the older, larger child, 6-year-old Devin, is attacked first and definitively murdered, while the younger, smaller Damon is left just barely alive, with the obvious truth being that he's going to succumb, help or no help. Let's examine the psychology of that. As a child, had I been forced into a physical confrontation with my mother, I believe I could have overpowered her, most likely starting around age 8. That's about the age where I'm confident that, if she had attacked me with her hands or an object, I feel like I could have not only defended myself, but maybe won, even given her size difference. Now, of course, we generally don't have physical altercations with our mothers, but if I try to place that same notion within the context of being 5 years old, my mother would have destroyed me in an altercation. Yet, if we move that to age 6, getting out of those earliest developmental years, I'm pretty confident that I could have given her a decent run for her money. In fact, I know for sure she wouldn't have been able to control me. And here we have the larger, 6-year-old Devin being stomped out first, before any screams from another victim would have the opportunity to allow him to wake up and defend himself. So if you're Darlie Routier, and you need to kill one kid knowing that it's going to wake the other, the obvious choice is to take Devin first so that he can't wake up and defend himself. So if Damon wakes up from Devin being stabbed, he's still a year younger, much smaller, and less physically capable of handling himself. Beyond that, due to his size and age, he's also more likely to die from the wounds that have not yet killed him. If he were older and larger, he might be able to hang on longer in the face of the injuries he's received. Regardless, the police are at the door, and they aren't going to allow the EMTs and the approaching ambulance to tend to the victims until the crime scene has been cleared. But Darlie doesn't want to open the door, because the truth is inside. She doesn't want to deal with the cops. She just wants to be taken away to the hospital with the kids. On the surface, this seems reasonable, as their health comes first, so Darlie is put on a gurney and led to an ambulance when the emergency services arrive. Darren follows alongside her, at which point she tells him she doesn't think she's going to make it. Of course, Darlie doesn't have any reason to believe she's going to die. She's just setting up what's coming next. Once she establishes that she might not see Darren again, it becomes normal for her to ask for him to promise something on her way out. Of course, it looks like Darlie committed these murders at this point, and she knows it, so she has to find out if her husband is still on her side. In that light, she asks him if he'll promise to find out who killed their babies. Obviously, he does. But the point is that, if Darren agrees with Darlie's request to find out who killed their babies, then the implication is that he doesn't believe she did it. With that answer, Darlie knows Darren is on her side, without ever saying she didn't do it, or even asking him if he thinks she did. That's how sociopaths and psychopaths operate. Darlie is most often described as a psychopath, but I find her behavior more consistent with that of a sociopath. Either way, manipulation is involved. And this is where that manipulation gets even worse. A sock is found in the alley behind the house. Only, it's about 75 yards away. And it's not just any sock. It belongs to Darren Routier. Furthermore, this sock has blood from both of his sons on it. And it's just sitting on the ground in the alley, about 3/4 of a football field away from the crime scene. Many suggest this indicates the presence of an intruder, but in reality it's just a silly ploy that can't disguise itself as anything less than totally shameful and remorseless. I mean, really, let's look at the sock for what it really is. An intruder wouldn't voluntarily take the sock unless the sock had a purpose. For instance, if this was a sex crime and perhaps a foot fetish was involved, it might be reasonable to suggest a correlation between the sock and the act of murder. In the case of the East Area rapist, he dropped a sock on the ground leaving a crime scene because he was being chased, and it was heavy due to being filled with coins. In fact, the DNA from that sock was instrumental in his capture. So, there are certainly occasions when it fits the bill, such as those I just mentioned, meaning circumstances where the sock is related to the killer's MO. And it's not like the sock in this case is soaked in blood, as though somebody walked through the crime scene in it. There are several spots of crimson on the white sock, leaving the impression that somebody held the item in at least one hand and dabbed it in each of the children's blood separately before leaving the home and disposing of it nearby. This is just beyond disgusting and brings me to another point about crimes of this nature. People like Darlie Routier seek men who will remain loyal in situations like these, and it's easy pickings in terms of knowing who won't jump ship on you. Undoubtedly, Darlie had been employing that same psychology on Darren every day since they met, and when this night came, it was simply an extension of that behavior he'd become accustomed to. I believe that behind closed doors, on a daily basis, Darlie was doing nothing different than she did on the night of June 6, 1996, only this time it culminated in murder. So, getting back to the sock, one would have to believe that the intruder either accidentally or intentionally took the item from the home. Let's look at both scenarios. If the sock was intentionally taken, but discarded in that state, the only purpose it would serve the intruder is a pathetic attempt at making Darren look like he was involved when he's actually sleeping upstairs at the home. If the sock left accidentally, there's no evidence it got attached to anybody's foot or clothing to allow that to happen. It appears the sock was most likely dropped in the spot. It wasn't dragged on the sticky heel of a shoe or anything similar to that. There's no blood evidence leading to the sock, yet anybody who struggled with Darlie moments before would have had to have stepped in blood numerous times. If you viewed the crime scene photos, there's no better way to put it than to say there's blood everywhere. But there's no sign of a man having walked through the scene, or away from the scene. aside from Darren Routier or anybody involved with law enforcement or emergency services. To me, the sock blatantly says that Darlie was gently trying to give the impression that her husband committed the murder because the only person who would be interested in Darren Routier's sock is Darren Routier. I mean, just look at the psychology of this piece of evidence. It excludes Darlie in every way. It says there was a killer present at the scene who wasn't her. It has Devin's blood on it. It has Damon's blood on it. And the sock belongs to Darren. Everybody involved in this incident, whether fabricated or real, is attached in some way to that sock. Except Darlie Routier. The evidence found outside the home suggests a connection to everyone but her. The murders, the neck slashing, the sock in the alley. Darlie Routier was desperate, depressed, hopeless, and at the end of her rope. In an ideal world, she was going to get away with the murders, whether by the cops validating the intruder theory or even coming to believe her husband was guilty due to the bloody sock found in the alley. I also think she'd have been okay with dying. Whatever the case, I believe she wanted the life she had to end. And it did. That's the bottom line. Darlie never had to care for any of her children again. In fact, as long as she lives, she'll never even be permitted physical contact with her son Drake. There will be no worries about bills, no nagging from the kids, no postpartum depression, and no other pressures of adult life to which one might succumb. There will only be the guarantee of what she wanted all along in life. For somebody to take care of her forever and unconditionally, for nothing in return. Ultimately, she found a situation that fits like a glove. Institutionalization. In fact, it's the only situation in society that allows such. So, it's not a coincidence that's where she went. Darlie is the equivalent of the man-child we've discussed many times, but female, obviously. Her external goal was to eradicate large expenses in her life to get more money, and her emotional internal goal was simply for the charade to end. She simply couldn't take it anymore. That's who does something like this. Someone desperate who needs a way out. So then, how would Darlie have committed the crime if it was actually her? The easiest path to the result we've witnessed is if Darlie is alone with the boys she wants to kill, at night and on a different floor from her husband. Notice that this crime takes place specifically on a night when Darlie and Darren are separated and not when they're together in bed, as they normally might be. A situation exists where Darlie can commit the crime in the absence of witnesses or interference, and in a surprise manner where the victims will be as vulnerable to attack as possible. So, I suggest she gets up after 2 a.m. and then goes and cuts the window screen in the garage. She then heads to the kitchen and gets the knife. The boys are asleep on the floor. She straddles Devin and attacks him from overhead before he even has a chance to wake up. By the time he does wake up, he's received at least one devastating wound that happened while he was motionless, and he's no longer fit to defend himself before enduring the remainder of the attack. If he manages to make any noise, that ends abruptly, as the attack was intentionally furious and fatal. Damon was most likely stirred by the attack on Devin, but immediately assaulted by Darlie as well, most likely straddled in the same way as his brother, though it stated he was face down and stabbed in the back. Cast-off blood was found on the back of Darlie's nightshirt, indicating she'd been stabbing downward at something and then pulling the knife back above her head. There's no blood evidence from an intruder, so it stands to reason the only people left in the home who could have been stabbed by Darlie were her two sons, who died from deep stab wounds delivered by a very long kitchen knife belonging to her. Anyhow, after stabbing the kids, I believe Darlie tossed the knife in the garage before taking the bloodstained sock down the alley. At that point, she comes back, ransacks the living room, inflicts the throat and arm slashes on herself, puts the knife back in the garage, and bleeds while lying on the couch and calling for Darren. Although she claims Damon woke her by crawling to her side, my guess is she likely just waited a short period of time until she believed a significant amount of blood had accumulated on her and proceeded to call 911 when it was apparent both boys were beyond help. And I wish I could say it's more complicated than that. But it's not. The jury deliberated for 9 hours on this case before finding Darlie Routier guilty. Unfortunately for her, this happened in Texas. And you know what that means. Darlie got the death penalty. So, while she's still alive and still proclaiming her innocence, we simply don't have any reason to believe her, and we never will. Or do we? Because while Darlie's injuries seem to have been fully accounted for by doctors and nurses at the hospital prior to her release, including photos taken to satisfy the police, she reports additional injuries several days later. And in other, more legitimate situations, I wouldn't make light of such a thing. But Darlie, again, engaging total disregard, has gone way overboard. She flaunts these bruises going up and down her arms, from wrist to shoulder, that look like sleeve tattoos more conducive to joining a rock band or a biker gang than convincing the cops they're legitimate in any way, shape, or form. But once again, Darlie attacks any angle she can get away with. Everybody knows bruises don't reach the stage of being blue, purple, or black immediately after the injury. At first, there might be little more than redness and swelling in the area. So Darlie goes that route. Except, when you look at the photo, you don't see the things in these bruises that are typical of an attack. First of all, Darlie loses consciousness during the supposed altercation, but has no injuries to her face or head, nor any signs of concussion. That means that, if she lost consciousness during the altercation, she made the decision to lie down on the couch. But the intruder doesn't take the easy kill. He passes. Then we have a living room that appears to have been ransacked, and two kids have been murdered, but the killer didn't strike Darlie in the face or head. So these bruises on her arm also don't seem to indicate she was grabbed by anybody. It appears as though the length of the arm was banged hard against something repeatedly with the sole intent of causing injury, specifically bruising. There are no marks consistent with grabbing or punching in specific areas. Just two entirely bruised arms. And not a scratch on her face. I mean, just try to picture yourself as a woman, being viciously attacked by a man who just murdered your children, but he refrains from stabbing you or even trying to kill you when you pass out, which is how he killed the kids when they were sleeping. But he spares you, and not only that, decides it's a great idea to leave you as a witness because you were such a good sport about enduring his relentless arm attacks. It's all pretty ridiculous. Yet this is where the story gets really silly. Literally. The family holds a memorial for the boys at their grave shortly after the murders, which includes a birthday celebration for Devin, who would have been turning 7 years old. Of course, this had become a sensational case by then, and all eyes, including the media, were on Darlie Routier. One would think she'd be mindful of her behavior, given the fact that there was suspicion of her involvement in the murder of her sons. But no, we don't get that. In fact, it's the antithesis of that. Darlie decides that it's a good idea to start smiling and giggling while singing to her son and spraying silly string all over his grave. It's a bizarre scene, almost surreal. And if not for the fact two children were murdered to precipitate it, it's absolutely hilarious. Now, it doesn't take a genius to figure out that this is going to be used against you in a court of law. And while it's shown to the jury no fewer than 6 times, Darlie's family believes it's the reason she was found guilty of the crime. And that's unfair, they say, because there was a serious memorial prior to the silly string that the media didn't report. Yet, none of this really matters, because the bottom line is that the video exhibited the one key behavioral factor common to sociopaths and psychopaths: disregard. They simply do not give a fuck, and often make it known. That's what the jury saw, and they decided to protect society from this monster. But in the end, this story is just ridden with loss. Darlie Routier lost her freedom, and perhaps soon it will be her life. Her sons, Devin and Damon, they had their days on this earth cut short, never to return. We won't know the men they might have become, or even the suffering they endured on their way out of this existence. And Darren Routier, he lost a wife and 2 children. Everything. And Drake? Drake lost a mother he never had a chance to know, as well as 2 brothers who will also remain ghosts forever. This family was gone in a flash. Here one day, and disintegrated the next. Forever. And I'm left silenced by that. But only for a moment. Then I ask myself, what is this world into which I've been born? Is it all a dream? A nightmare? How will I retain my dignity in the face of eternal darkness, preceded by only a moment of light? And within a flesh and blood body that grows old and withers in time, I look around me for answers at the swirling chaos of evolutionary desire. It all just keeps spinning so wildly, around and around again. The love, the hate, the sex, the isolation, the giving, the taking, the wanting, the needing, the crying, in cribs, in doctor's offices, at the news of your illness, at the wedding, the funeral, for the guy who had a heart attack, whose wife couldn't pay for the services, where the hearse driver did coke, because he's lonely and scared of something he can't see. Like the rest of us, who do what we can to cope, to drink, to think, to smoke, to learn that we're falling apart and getting stronger. We're improving, declining, deceiving, helping, hurting, killing, starving, for love, for a meal, for a place to call home, for somebody's hand to hold, for a chance to go back in time and change things, because we won't do it today. Tomorrow sounds better. To pay the bills, to face the music, to tell her I fucked a billy goat, and that it was just a joke. On me. Every fucking thing in this world seems like that. A tragedy. I should read more and be more knowledgeable so I can die pretentious and thin. I would do anything to be thin. In my mind. In their minds. No. Be yourself. Love yourself. But never stop changing. Post inspirational quote for others and ignore the advice. Go to therapy. Take pills. No. Don't. Yes. No. Okay. Yes. I hate when people walk behind me. It's worse as they get closer. How many years do I have left to live? Do the math. Oh, okay. I'll do nothing for a while longer. I can't believe I did nothing all those years. I'll never get them back. They're gone. Everything is. It's all gone. But I have to pick up the dry cleaning today. I have no money. I can't pay the rent. I'm going to be homeless. I'm going to be rich. I'm definitely getting the job. Surprise, I didn't get it. I'll pay you $30,000 for that car, and 20 times that for your house. Your mother is sick. The stock market crashed. You lost everything. Congratulations, you're a winner, a loser, a convict, a lawyer, a doctor, a diabetic, a stranger, a murder victim, a visitor in a dentist chair, a liar, a cheater, a lover, a fighter, a defendant, waiting for the verdict, for your blood test results, for the bad news, for the orgasm, for the end of time, of suffering, of screaming in our hearts and minds that never stop wanting and fronting and faking and forsaking. All of these things were given. And with that, I wonder, who are we? Are we angels or truly just monsters? So much of what we do to push the world forward ends up pushing us off a cliff. Is there such a thing as evil? Or is the truth that we just can't hide from who we are? No matter how many times I ask myself that question, I don't have an answer. It isn't something I can articulate. It remains a question, a desire for expression. So in that light, I'm going to allow Darlie Routier to take this one down the home stretch for me right now and try to tell you why it is I can't reconcile the nature of love and hate in this world, of good and evil, and of light and darkness. Think of everything we've just discussed in this case as you listen, and then maybe, just maybe, we'll get an answer to the most important question of all. Who am I? And we'll realize the fleeting truth in this matter, even if we can't put it to words. The following audio recording is Darlie Routier singing to her youngest son, Drake, from within the confines of a prison, on his birthday. Mother and child have had no physical contact since her conviction, and never will again. For better or worse, I think this moment says everything about life that any one of us ever needs to know.
Yeah, yeah, looks like we made it. Look how far we've come, my baby. I'm glad we didn't listen. Look at what we would be missing. They said, I bet they'll never make it. But just look at us go and home. We're still together, still going strong. Still the one, you're still the one I run to, the one that I belong to. You're still the one I want for life. Still the one, you're still the one that I love, the only one I dream of. You're still the one I kiss goodbye.